Well, good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable. It's a Friday edition of the Roundtable panel. It's a fun drive edition of the Roundtable panel, and we are very excited. We have a wonderful group this morning. We have money to make. We have things to discuss. We have your letters to read. So we have a lot going on, and we will get going here. I just want to a couple of things. First of all, we are we're at $882,000 raised in the fund drive, and what we want to do in the next hour—that's until 10 o'clock this morning—is get to $892,000. So bring in $10,000, and if we do that, Susan from Woodstock will give us $10,000. That's amazing. Wow. That's absolutely amazing. That's a big chunk, a good $5,000. So all we have to do is make $10,000, and we've done these all week. We've made them, which has been lovely. So don't screw that up. All you have to do. 1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. WAMC.org. And we would love to have you be a part of what we're doing this morning, which is helping this radio station, saving this radio station, preserving this radio station, conserving this radio station. And an amazing morning with the group today. With Ray and David and Sam and everybody. It was fantastic. Thank you all who called in and did your thing. But we still have work to do this morning. We'll be doing this till 10 o'clock this morning and then have a community partnership coming up on at 10 o'clock. So $10,000 in the next 50 minutes will get us $5,000 from Susan from Woodstock. 1-800-323-9262, and don't worry, I will mention this all the time, and you will know where we are in this project as we move forward. 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. As I was sitting here, I walked in, and I was getting ready to come on and getting my directions from our fund drive coordinator and the wonderful Lizzie Honan, and who was telling me about what we needed to do, and I was getting my marching orders. And I came in, and I had not met the panel yet, and I sat down, and I look up, and all the panel is wearing black. I don't know what. Everyone's wearing black. Now, I understand the Reverend. That makes sense. But the rest of, I don't know. It's just interesting. But I feel like overly, you know.
Colorful.
Colorful and happy. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of that dark New York attire, you know.
Yes, that, yeah. Very fitting for what we'll be discussing this morning. No doubt at all. I think we should all be in mourning in one way or the other. But, you know, let me get that closer to you. Let me introduce everyone, and we'll get started. We welcome the Reverend Peter Cook, Principal of Faith in the Public Square and co-principal of the Religious Nationalisms Project. New panelist was with us once before. We are thrilled that he is back. Adds so much to this program, and we're delighted you are here. Thank you very much. We very much appreciate it.
It's a pleasure
it.
To be here.
Thank you. We welcome Siena University Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti. Good morning, Aaron. It seems like it's been a while. I like seeing you again.
It's nice to see you too. Yeah, it was end of the semester meetings and commencement and all that jazz. So I gave myself a little pause.
Yeah, that's all right. That's good.
But I'm back with a vengeance.
All right. You have a rather relaxing summer now or no?
It's a different speed. So I can work from home. I can do my writing and research from home and putter around in my garden and take excessively long naps. So sure.
That sounds very good. Yeah, that sounds absolutely terrific. We also welcome Catherine Tan, Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. And what a pleasure to have you here. Thank you very much.
Good morning.
How are things going in your world?
Pretty good. I am also on summer break, also working from home, but just as busy as when the semester was in.
Yeah, there's always stuff to do.
Always.
There are always things to do. Well, good morning, all. We have a lot to discuss this morning. We'll get to it. Don't forget that $10,000 that we have to make in the $5,000 challenge that we have. 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. And we want you to be a part of this because we have to have you as a part of this. It's all of us coming together that will make this a reality and end this fun drive and get us back to regular programming. We have, as I mentioned, a lot of items to discuss, and we will start with number one here, which is a different story than I sent out to the group initially, which was that of the negotiations that were going on regarding this immigration bill. And then last night, the Senate passed a $70 billion GOP immigration bill, a victory for President Trump and his party, though the debate exposed fissures between Republican senators and Mr. Trump on a variety of issues. And so the Senate Republicans passed this bill to fund President Trump's immigration crackdown after beating back bipartisan efforts to add language to bar or sharply restrict a federal payout fund for his political allies. Construction projects. An appeals court panel will hear arguments on Friday over Mr. Trump's White House ballroom project and whether he had legal authority to bulldoze part of the complex without congressional approval. But Senate Republicans rammed through the New York Times language through their $70 billion bill to fund President Trump's immigration crackdown through the remainder of his term after beating back bipartisan efforts to add the language to bar or sharply restrict a federal payout fund for his political allies. The 52-47 vote early Friday morning sent the measure to the House, which was expected to move quickly to pass it. And we look at that. It was a victory for the president and his party, who have been eager to spotlight their hardline immigration stance and Democratic opposition to it in the middle of an election year when their control of the Congress is at stake. Senator Lisa Murkowski, Republican of Alaska, was the only Republican to oppose the measure, joining all Democrats. But passage came only after Republican leaders quelled an internal revolt that had been simmering for weeks over recent moves by Mr. Trump that have underscored how his personal agenda is diverging sharply from the party's political interests. The divisions threatened to sink the measure and prompted several GOP defections on bipartisan efforts to modify it, all of which failed in an hours-long series of back-and-forth votes that stretched all day Thursday and into the pre-dawn hours of Friday. Democrats orchestrated votes seeking to force Republicans to weigh in for the record on unpopular moves the president has made, including his plan to create a $1.8 billion payout fund to compensate people who he claims have been victimized by the government, his push for $1 billion in federal funding for his White House ballroom project, and his decision to name the housing secretary, Bill Pulte, as the nation's top intelligence official. While Republicans were strongly unified around the immigration bill itself, it had become the source of rare Republican pushback to Mr. Trump as GOP lawmakers revolted over his request for the ballroom and the payout fund, which many of them feared could be used to pay members of the pro-Trump mob who attacked the Capitol with lawmakers on January 6th. Still, in the end, while some Republicans broke with the president on those matters during hours of votes that continued into Friday morning, most of them swallowed their concerns and united to defeat Democrats' efforts to tie Mr. Trump's hands. The result was the success of Republicans' move to use a special filibuster-proof budget bill that was never meant for routine funding matters. I'll tell you, Aaron, I understand some of that, but not all.
There's a lot going on in that, isn't there?
There sure is. So I apologize for being dense on this, but I don't really know the answer to this after reading this. But as of my reading, the $1.8 billion fund is still a part of this. This has not been, and will move forward unless courts intervene.
That was my read on it as well, is that the $1.8 billion reparation fund or recruitment fund, you could call it, for Trump and his allies is still very much in play. And unless they're, Trump sees this as a victory. I'm sure there'll be future pushback on this because Republicans kind of made it clear that they see this as a liability heading into the midterm. So I wouldn't be surprised if maybe something comes up in the future that's not attached to immigration funding. But there's a few things to consider here. And the first is the optics of this, and that is the just where Trump is placing his priorities. And that is using taxpayer dollars to essentially transfer money from them to his allies at his own discretion. That's, you know, grift at a fairly obscene level. And then there's the second point is the opportunity cost of this. And that is, you know, I wonder how many swing voters going into the midterm see this as perhaps not the best use of the funding, right? This was the, you know, America First was his big campaign promise, and we're failing to see this. He's picking these fights in other areas, both geopolitically and domestically. And I think Republicans do see this as a liability. I bet this comes up again before the midterms. And I wouldn't be surprised if it just slowly disappears from the discussion.
I also want to juxtapose these decisions with, well, so we have Republicans pushing for and passing the new, $70 billion budget to fund ICE, even though, as we have seen over the last 2 years, that, you know, these efforts are not effective. They are terrorizing communities. Many of the people who are being picked up are people who are here on asylum or trying to seek asylum, who have not been given the pathways toward documentation. And a lot of these pathways are impeded by ICE agents terrorizing outside of courts, right? I have friends who work, you know, within the community trying to help these families and their children gain documentation. And they are constantly being experiencing interference with these intimidation tactics. You know, they say that the ICE is supposed to help us kick out violent migrants, but most of the people who are being picked up are not the violent actors that they are describing. At the same time, you know, I think it's just so absolutely outrageous that given all the Republicans that are against, you know, at least behind the scenes, against the anti-weaponization payout, are not willing to restrict this payout, right? And this payout, $1.8 billion, I just want to juxtapose that with what happened yesterday as well that is not receiving the same level of attention, which is the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infant, and Children, better known as WIC, lost $141 million in funding, right? This is money that goes to food for women and babies and children, right? Which is outrageous because $141 million, what is that? That you seven times the $1.8 billion payout is seven times more than the $141 million that we lost. That's supposed to go towards food for vulnerable populations. These are poor women and children who are being having this food budget cut into at a time when the cost of groceries are outrageous and people are struggling with affordability. So on the one hand, you have our Congress saying no to vulnerable population, no to funding food, which is a basic need, and saying yes to deporting hardworking people who are trying to make a life in the United States and take advantage of, you know, this, you know, mirage of an American dream. And you have them also supporting this fund to help essentially what I would consider domestic terrorists, right? And it's wild because, you know, the people who showed up on January 6th, they've already been given clemency. They've already been given pardon. So what are we doing here?
That's reparations for them and for whatever.
They're the last group to deserve reparations.
Sorry to interrupt, Peter. I wanted to add one thing to what Catherine said, and that is another justification for the deportations was the economic rationale, and that is immigrants are taking jobs from American workers, particularly workers in the manufacturing sector. And it's worth pointing out that since Trump took office, manufacturing employment has declined by 80,000. So it's not even accomplishing its stated economic objectives.
So what I think is so disappointing about this is that Congress got caught up in this debate about the weaponizations fund, and that was where the focus was, instead of really having the open public debate about the issues we just talked about in terms of funding this, you know, $70 billion for ICE, neglecting, you know, nutrition programs. And, you know, that's what the public needed to see in a debate. And I would also just say that this settlement should have never happened in the first place. You know, it's an illegal settlement. You know, basically the president sued himself and said, hey, you know, we're suing the IRS for $10 billion. And people are like, well, no, you really can't do that. Well, you know, let's make a deal here and I will settle for, you know, $1.8 billion and still have all this stuff about immunity from prosecution. This is the settlement, but the problem is that the lawsuit was illegal and the settlement itself, whatever shape it took, was illegal. And so, you know,
in an agreement, not even a settlement.
Yeah. And so really, this is why, you know, we have two lawsuits through the courts to really call the propriety of the settlement in whatever shape into question.
We started needing $10,000 to get a $5,000 challenge from Susan from Woodstock. We are needing $9,300 now, $9,369 in the next 32 minutes. Whatever you can do, please do it and help us out. We have a lot of money to make in a short period of time to get this $5,000 and to raise the total for our June fund drive and to make sure that we are indeed on course and we can end this soon and get back to regular programming. 1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org. And the House will go after this, and I don't expect there to be a kerfuffle.
No. They'll fall in line.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just outrageous, and you know, the $70 billion of funding for ICE, while we are cutting back in our spending to invest in the social safety net, and these other priorities, which really get shoved aside in favor of funding a almost like a private army
right
to go after immigrants, you know.
And I'm really, you know, there's so much concern about the midterm elections, and what is the logic here when so much of their base is suffering as well? You know, this is, I know we're going to talk about it in a moment, but, you know, the job market is horrible for new graduates and many other people. affordability remains one of the top issues in this country that impacts everyone across the board, doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican. And yet he's going after these issues that are so distant from people's everyday lives. So I'm curious, what is the calculation and logic? And, you know, so much of this, it is just a really perverse loyalty test, right? You know, pushing forward something like an anti-weaponization payout, like you have to truly be a major loyalist to vote against your interests in this way.
I have to pause you there. We'll take a break and be right back after this. The music of House of Hamill this morning for our panel as we talk about the issues of the day on the roundtable panel, and also have a special edition because we're also doing the fund drive as we speak. We are in the middle of a challenge. Susan from Woodstock, $5,000. Will give us $5,000 if we can bring in $10,000 by 10 o'clock this morning. That is when we end this part of the program. Currently, according to the magical calculator, we are at $9,100. So we have quite a ways to go. I do hope that we can make this. Please do whatever you can. 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. And please do whatever you can. 1-800-323-9262. All right, so let's continue with the news. American employers hired vigorously in May in a sign that the labor market is on a genuine upswing after last year's lull. The economy added 172,000 last month, more than economists had expected, while the unemployment rate stayed at 4.3%. The robust reading follows other data suggesting that labor demand has found its footing after a year of trade policy swings, immigration enforcement disruption, and an exodus from the federal government, with revisions March and April added 93,000 more jobs than previously reported. That puts average job growth in 2026 at about 114,000 positions per month, much stronger than the 10,000 average last year. That's much faster than the rate at which people have been coming into the labor market. The Trump administration has squeezed net immigration to near zero. To tell us what this means, we go to our jobs report maven, Aaron Pacitti.
I'm still waiting for the bumper music.
Yeah, I know.
For this slot, I know you guys have other things to do with fundraising.
Well, we got to get the money for the music.
I know.
Yeah.
another surprisingly strong employment report. Like you said, the economy added 172,000 jobs, and that past month's job gains were revised up by 93,000. So in one way, this is another strong report. Similar to what we saw in April, the unemployment rate remained unchanged at 4.3%. So it definitely appears that there is some upswing in what's been happening, but there's some, I don't want to say warning signs, but some things that might suggest that the labor market isn't as strong as previously thought. Of all of the unemployed workers, 25% of them have been unemployed for more than 26 weeks. Mm-hmm. So the fear is that for workers who lose their job, they're going to remain unemployed for a much longer period than they were in the past, and that creates on-the-job insecurity. And one of the ways that plays out is, you know, workers have less bargaining power or are less willing to ask for wage increases. And what we've seen for the first time since Trump took office is the rate of inflation, meaning the increase in the cost of living, exceed wage growth. So in May, the inflation rate increased by 3.8%, but wages in May only increased by 3.4%. So we're starting to see people's paychecks lag the rise in the cost of living. And that's something that economists will be monitoring to see how the inflationary effects, particularly with the war in Iran and food and fuel prices, compares to pay increases. The other interesting thing is job gains were not particularly widespread. They were primarily concentrated in leisure and hospitality, which is a sign of discretionary spending, which could be viewed as a good thing, and healthcare. But these were not broad-based job gains that suggest an economy that is on extremely firm footing. So the affordability hoax, as Trump called it, and as Catherine pointed out, is very real, and it's becoming increasingly intense as gas prices continue to go up, as there seems to be no real strategy or exit plan for what's happening in Iran. Food prices are inching up and surely likely to increase further because a lot of what comes out of Iran and the Strait of Hormuz is fertilizer. So it's not surprising that despite this strong job market, consumer confidence is at a 50-year low. Consumers feel pessimistic about the future. They feel pessimistic on average about their ability to get a job. So that's partly a response to this low hiring, low firing job market. And as Joe mentioned, that in 2026, the economy added a surprisingly large number of jobs. But on average, since Trump took office, the economy only added 27,000 jobs a month on average, which is not enough to keep pace with population growth. But the president has said, I mean, when he goes on air and says affordability is a Democratic hoax, that he doesn't care about the financial consequences of what he's doing in Iran in terms of how it affects American households, that hurts the psychology of, you know, your average family and makes them more pessimistic and perhaps, you know, particularly with swing voters, more likely to vote for the non-incumbents in the midterms. But the big news about this, and this is going to be another interesting thing to watch, is that with inflation going up and a job market that appears to be on reasonably firm footing, like I said, there's no flashing red lights that suggest that, you know, the job market's on the tip of falling off a cliff, is that it really gives the Federal Reserve no indications that lowering interest rates is warranted, right? If the job market's on firm footing, when the Fed lowers interest rates, they do that to stimulate growth and to counteract increases in unemployment. But we haven't seen those. And that's why Trump appointed Kevin Warsh as chair of the Fed to do precisely that. So when you're faced with rising inflation and what appears to be a reasonably healthy job market, the appropriate monetary policy response would be to raise rates to slow growth, to depress inflation. But that would be Kevin Warsh biting the hand that has been feeding him. So it's going to be a very interesting the last half of 2026 in terms of what happens to the labor market and the economy, because, I mean, personally, I was surprised to see that we added as many jobs as we did. But like I said, there's still some signs that things might not be as rosy as the headline statistics indicate.
Well, okay, so we have job growth, but as you mentioned, a lot of these jobs are in leisure and hospitality. So I'm just hearing service jobs.
Right. Lower paying service jobs.
Exactly.
Right.
So even with a growth in the number of jobs that are now available, are these good jobs? Are these jobs that can actually, that people can survive when working full time? And I think that is an entirely different question, right? And it can create this illusion that we're doing well, but are we actually doing well when these are lower paying jobs?
And let me just add to that a letter that we got from Tim, who said the BBC is reporting the jobs are mainly hospitality from the World Cup hiring up. So is this just a blip and not a trend?
Right. Will this sustain?
So I think I would look at this in a little more of a structural or historical lens, in the sense that post-pandemic, we saw a lot of massive investment in, well, I guess what we call a bottom-up, middle-out kind of approach to economics, which created a lot more jobs and
across many different sectors, but that also pushed up inflation some, which is true. But now what we have is with the passage of the big, beautiful bill that we now reverted from that sort of middle out, bottom up approach to the more traditional trickle down approach, which is if you give a lot more money to rich people, it's going to trickle down into the economy. And so while there might be some economic benefit that comes from that, it's just not going to be very robust. And then when you pair that with the fact that even with this trickle-down approach, you still have an inflationary cycle due to the, you know, tariffs and excessive amounts of defense spending, which does not generate the kinds of jobs that that come in other kinds of sectors, that you now have a much flatter job market than you thought you'd get, plus you get inflation. And then the final thing is that people just have less money to spend in the economy because you're straining the social safety net.
The trickle-down thing does, I mean, that's not often how it works. But right now, especially in this landscape, with so much money being invested in AI, what we're seeing is job loss because of it. Right. Mm-hmm. So it is the opposite of the trickle down theory, which most of the time is not a thing. And when we're looking at recent graduates, we both have. We're very proud of our recent graduates. At the same time, there's no denying that they are having a really hard time in this current market. Their unemployment rate is at 5.7%, which is higher than the national rate. And more than 40% of new graduates, or I believe it's not even new graduates, people under 29, are underemployed. So they are not sufficiently employed. They're not employed in the areas that they're trained to work in. And at the same time, we're also, and some of that, you know, you can attribute to AI. You can also attribute that to working remotely. But happening at the same time is like the experience creep, where a lot of employers now are looking for people with more experience. And so a lot of young people who are entering the market right now just don't, they don't have anywhere to go. So maybe they are being, you know, college graduates are being pushed into these jobs that do not require, you know, a bachelor's degree, which is very concerning to me because we need people to be educated and we would like to for them to be placed.
Two things. One is we're at $8,600 that we need for this. We have 15 minutes to go. 1-800-323-9262. And by this, I mean a challenge that we have before us, where we make $10,000 and we get $5,000. Right now, we need this $8,600 to make that happen. We're up against a break, but go ahead, Aaron.
Catherine brought up a good point, and that is there's an alternative measure of unemployment, which includes workers who want to work full-time but can only find part-time work, workers who have dropped out of the labor force, so they're not actively looking for work and not counted as unemployed, and that figure is 8.1%. Mm. So one out of every 12 workers is either unemployed or underemployed, which is...
That's really high.
That is high. That's again, like I said, it kind of masks these headline numbers of unemployment rate remains at 4.3%, economy adding jobs, but like you pointed out, these are in lower paying sectors, and as the letter writer pointed out, and I didn't even think of this, is that since there's so many leisure and hospitality jobs added, that seems to be a seasonal anomaly. But I think it's probably fair to at least make an educated guess that that's probably partly due to the World Cup and that these cities that are just ramping up hiring for temporary jobs that might not be here in 3 months.
These numbers are not matching up with people's actual lived on the ground
which is why consumer confidence is at a 50-year low.
Yeah, and to have the president come out and say he's not thinking about affordability or the economy, like these are the issues that impact people in the most immediate sense. And to say something like that is really, it's for one, it's dismissive, and you should not, that, you know, that is one of the key issues that leaders should be working on. I'm not surprised. Of course, I'm not surprised.
He's not acting presidential in that way.
Really? Right, but it, at the same time, it also pushes blame on individuals and individual families to say that you know, this is something, this is your own personal matter to take care of. When people are trying to gain employment, right? And the jobs that are available are not secure jobs. And if a lot of these, a lot of the rise in employment is because of the World Cup, like that's the, and or just the fact that it's summer, right? And people are on are vacationing. It does not offer any real stability, right? And as you have young people entering the market with no jobs for them to have, like this is, you know, we can talk about this in the immediate sense of who's, you know, how many people are unemployed, but this is going to have long-term impacts on people building wealth, or in this case, not building wealth.
So I just think that, I mean, the basic problem here is that Trump never really cared about affordability. He still doesn't care about affordability, because if he did, he would not be investing so much money at the top and disinvesting in the economy, which would actually produce widespread job growth across all sectors.
And don't forget, he's also investing in the regilding of statues in front of the Lincoln Memorial.
Oh, I forgot.
There are many.
I don't know what the economic multiplier there. Effect is there.
We'll take a break. We'll update you on where we are in our challenge, and we'll wrap up with our wonderful group this morning. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. Catherine Tan is here. We welcome Peter Cook and Aaron Pasitti, and it's a delight to have you all here on this Friday morning. Now, we have a challenge underway, and we really want to get going and do what we can do here. 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC, and I'm going to give you a total here in just a second, and well, I'll work on the math. In the meantime, speaking of math, long term, and I guess, you know, you look at rosy numbers or good numbers or strong reports. But, I mean, Catherine and both Peter and Catherine made this point, as did you. But people know the reality.
Right.
Right? They know how they feel when they go to do anything. So when does that catch up, do you think?
Soon. The fact that wage growth is slowing, the fact that, you know, gas prices are up 60% since at the beginning of March, that the people's reality is very much at odds with the headline numbers from the jobs report, because a lot of the growth that the U.S. economy has experienced, not only in the past, you know, year and a half since Trump took office, but going back to the early 1980s with the advent of trickle-down or supply-side economics, has been that most of the growth that's been experienced in the U.S. economy has been taken by the richest 1%. Mm-hmm. And even within that, what we're seeing now is that it's not even the richest 1% who's experiencing the majority of the gains. It's the richest 0.1% of the population, which are billionaires, right? The richest 1%, you're looking at millionaires and billionaires. But we have a pro-billionaire form of economic policy. You can see that with the budget bill. You can see that with Trump has appointed to his cabinet and what some of those policy recommendations are. You can see that in his fairly blatant dismissal of the constraints and challenges that normal households are facing, that, you know, we live in an economy that is largely designed to benefit billionaires, because billionaires have been given the opportunity after Citizens United was the Supreme Court's decision on Citizens United, contribute almost unlimited funds to political campaigns. So we've got this vicious cycle where the economic elite have captured the political process by being able to install candidates of their choice. Those candidates are beholden to them. They pass policies that further enrich them. And it's a cycle that's very difficult to break. So in the long term, the economy faces enormous headwinds in terms of broad-based growth that Peter was alluding to. We're just not going to see that unless there is some very radical change in economic policy. And, you know, you hear Bernie Sanders talk about it, but the likelihood of it getting through any Congress is exceptionally low.
And I just, you know, just to reinforce that when you just give billions and billions of dollars to the very richest people and you disinvest in childcare, you disinvest in building or preserving affordable housing, you stress people out in terms of their medical plans with these high deductibles that make a lot of these plans sort of unusable, mm-hmm. and then also cut people off from even accessing healthcare if you're an immigrant or, you know, an immigrant or, you know, fall through the cracks in some other kind of way. That massive shift of wealth from investment in those things to the top 1 or 0.1% just has to have a devastating effect on the job market and the economy as a whole.
Catherine?
I completely agree with that, and I'm a sociologist, so this is something that we discuss extensively in different dimensions of it in all of my classes. The hope that trickle down economics works is something that we're shown time and time again it doesn't, right? And you know, these billionaires are not they're not tax as much as the rest of us, right? When they should be. They are not, there's this expectation that they would, you know, out of the goodness of their hearts contribute philanthropically, which they do not do. Like they're, you know, so we need laws and policies to make sure that the wealth is distributed so that we don't end up with this hollowing out where, you know, you have everyone, you know, you have the richest people owning everything and everyone getting nothing. Where we are right now, the top 1% has 30% of this nation's wealth. I mean, we think about it, that's wild. 1%, the top 1% owning 30%. That leaves, yeah, that's so much. The disparity is just egregious. And then to tell people that they need to bootstrap is even more outrageous, because how can you when the entire system is designed in such a way that explicitly gives favors and opportunities and tax breaks to those at the top and who need it the least. So I can't imagine how, I mean, I feel very disillusioned. I can't imagine how, you know, a lot of the college graduates and young people feel right now as they're entering into this world that, you know, at least when I was growing up, there was this at least illusion that you can, you know, work hard and, you know, buy a home and, you know, pay for childcare and do all of these things. And that, you know, a lot of people a lot of young people now are recognizing that that is not true. And I can't imagine what that's low morale will do to this country, and more substantively, what the lack of opportunities will do for the future, right? And how are people supposed to build any sort of wealth in this environment?
We need to take a break, and I guess we are we're going to go over to Pledge Central. My thanks to everyone for being with us this morning. It was a great, always a great pleasure to have you in the studio and to discuss these matters. 1-800-323-9262, WAMC.org to help out. Catherine, Peter, Aaron, you're the best. Thank you so much. Be well. We'll continue with the roundtable and more after this.